So today on Talk on to Walk on Patrick, we've got Ethna Brown. And Ethna is a bit of a heroine of mine because she is the most phenomenal performer. She's a singer and an actress who has the most incredible story to tell from her early days being brought up in Liverpool with fabulous Irish roots. And how she went from a shop girl to the starring in the London's West End of Blood Brothers alongside Barbara Dixon back in the 80s. Blood Brothers had a huge impact on me, as you know. I know all the words. And we've been to see it together, haven't we, in our many trips to the theatre. And also, she then went on to be in Brookside, if people remember Brookside, that Liverpool soap opera, which was incredibly famous in the 80s and early 90s. I can't remember when it finished, but yeah, so she played a fabulous character called Chrissy Rogers. Ethna also, more locally, is the star of theatre in Liverpool. Everybody knows who she is. If you haven't seen Ethna in one of our Liverpool, especially Royal Court performances, where have you been? I can't wait for her to share her story. She's currently in A Thong for Europe. How about that for a great title? given that we have, Liverpool have just hosted the Eurovision Song Contest. What a week we've had. So I'm really excited to talk to her, but especially excited about to talk about her mindset. I won't say how old she is right now. I'll get her permission to do that when we chat. But let's just say she is a great example of age is just a number. So I'm really excited to talk to her. And I know you've done a little bit of research on her as well, haven't you?
Absolutely, yeah. Your point about mindset, definitely want to understand what keeps her going, that sort of resilience and the perseverance for anybody in that sort of the theatre world throughout her whole life. And even now, she still has that passion and energy. And I'd love to know where she gets that from. And then on a sort of more personal basis, there are a couple of common themes in terms of her dad was in the Merchant Navy, as my dad was too. Mm-hmm. And being in the theatre, my mom was in the theatre, albeit in amateur dramatics. She wasn't a professional like Ethna was. So it'd be great to be able to talk through some of those stories with her too.
Yeah. So again, as we always say, I'm going to do the interview with Ethna. Patrick's going to play the role of our listener, and he will come back in to join us around three quarters of the way through. But I have to say, you might have to wave because me and Ethna, we can talk. So please do remind me, Patrick, if we're yattering away and we're getting a bit carried away on our timing. So with no further ado, let's bring Ethna in and let's talk on to walk on with Ethna Brown and see where it leads. Ethna, welcome to Talk On to Walk On. Eurovision Week, I have to just ask you, what the hell? How amazing for Liverpool?
I absolutely loved it. I truly did. I was slightly city anxious when we got it.
Yes.
You know the way we're portrayed so often in the media and everything. And I was a little bit... We were opening ourselves up to so much criticism or whatever, and instead it's been brilliant. The city has shown itself to be open, welcoming. It looked clean. It looked, they showed us how we could be our best, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I'll miss the colour. I'll miss the vibrancy. I'll miss the voices of all of these, you know, these wonderful people walking around. Just having a great time. The vibe in the city was extraordinary.
And I think, like you say, most people were perhaps, apart from probably the culture team who have pulled these incredible events off for many years, headed up by Claire McColgan. Yeah. Freedom of the City, Claire, that's all I'm going to say, and her team, hoping to get Claire on, probably in 2026 when she's woke up. But, you know, I think, like you say, we were all a little bit like, oh, I mean, we knew we could do it, but I just didn't expect them to absolutely smash it out the water, literally out of the River Mersey, as we, you know, they just, it was Ukraine's party, but it was in our backyard on our waterfront. The combination of those two elements were just made it really magical, didn't it? It was just fabulous.
It was just wonderful.
A Thong for Europe. I'm actually just going to emphasise the TH.
Please.
What a phenomenal title, and what perfect timing and marketing. Whoever leapt on that as soon as they knew we were getting Liverpool was getting the Eurovision. Absolute kudos to them. Was it Stephen Fletcher?
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
That's exactly what happened. Stephen Fletcher, Jonathan Harvey and Stephen had wanted to work together. And when this was announced, Jonathan was straight onto Stephen going, look, how about this? Stephen was like, great, the Royal Court really up for it. In fact, they had to sort of move a couple of the shows that were going to be on at the court, just move them further back on the calendar so we could fit Thong in.
Just the intro to it, Lulu, born in Waterloo, conceived to the beat of the ABBA tambourine, you know, only drinks Bucks Fizz. It's like, what? That's spot on. Okay, where do I sign? And then she stalks Sonia or something.
It's just wonderful. Everybody gets the chance to shine as well. Kevin Fearon wanted Jonathan, I think, to write for the Royal Court. So when this opportunity came up and they offered it to him, Jonathan was like, yeah, Kevin took it on board. As I say, move shows aside. And so he and Stephen were working on this, but it's got everything. It's got the songs are woven into the storyline in a really clever way. I'm working with some of my best friends on stage, so I'm having an absolute ball. We all are. The audiences have reflected that. They're on their feet. They're dancing.
Yeah.
It was just part of this amazing, amazing citywide adventure.
But what I was going to just ask you about is at the end of a show like that every night, I mean, we did two songs with Jamie Webster on the opening night and I was done for nothing the next day. I was like done in, and I was knowing you were coming on. I was like, how do you switch off? Because I was just singing My City, My People, My Heart for about 2 weeks with one song.
I love that anthem,
Isn't it amazing?
I love him.
I was done in. We were both done in the next day. I mean, it was a long day, 9:30 till 10 o'clock, and we did have a couple of drinks at the end. But I was done in, and I never stopped singing the music. So at the end of each show, Ethna, I know you like your walking. Do you walk home, or what do you do to, like...
I don't walk home. excuse me. What we've loved to have done ever since we started with Brick Up, after the show, we'll try and meet people in the bar. Now it's the courtyard next door. Thanks so much for coming. What did you think? They're your best critics. That's how you know the show is either going well or not so well, because people will tell you the truth. And you absolutely love it. You see people who may be coming back year after year, show after show, so you get to know them well. I don't drink. Well, obviously I drink water, otherwise I'd be dead, but I don't drink alcohol anymore. And I can just like look at everybody having that great time. And now I know when to leave the party. So great with everybody. Have a good. And then what I've enjoyed doing is just walking through the streets before I, you know, get into a taxi or jump the bus with my pass. So, but I do like to walk a bit first, just get the air, you know, just reflect on what the evening's been, who you've met, who you've talked to. I do count my blessings.
I know. And it could be because we will come back to Brick Up and that wonderful family feeling in a bit. But obviously I know it's a well-told story, but you have the most beautiful story of your upbringing and how you got into, you went from shop girl to Blood Brothers on the West End. I have heard you tell it, but can you please just tell it again just for my own total selfish benefit and obviously the people who are going to listen to this who haven't heard your story.
No, but what it was,
truly inspirational.
It was quite funny. No, it was quite funny because years and years and years ago, well, obviously, we're pushing 70 next year, so we're going back to my 20s. 50 years ago. about 50 years ago, I was working at a beautiful place called the Medici Gallery on Bell Street, which is now sadly gone. And it was there. It was so long ago, we used to do half-day Saturdays. So the group of us and had great friends working there. So we left the gallery on the Saturday about 12 o'clock and went for a picnic in the gardens behind the cathedral, St. James's Gardens. We had a flagon of cider from Odd Bins down the road. We had all sorts of treats and things from Matters and various places. And the 5-6 of us picnicked. And I'd started singing And our manageress was like, oh, I never knew you could sing. She passed my name on to somebody else. They were looking for a singer for a group. That sort of didn't work out. But the guy who was a keyboard player was helping to arrange music for some bloke called Willie Russell for a show called Blood Brothers. Now, by this time, I was working in a place called Gemini Blinds on London Road. I could have sold many people listening their Venetian blinds. And I got a phone call saying, hello, you don't know me, but I believe you can sing. And I was convinced it was mates, you know, wanting getting to, you know, trying to get me sing down the phone and then burst out laughing. Anyway, it turned out he was the musical director at the Liverpool Playhouse. And I went to this house on East Prescott Road next to the Holy Spirit Church. There was a studio set up. So I would listen to these songs that Willie had written very simply, which we now know as Easy Terms and, you know, Tell Me It's Not True. And I would sing all the harmonies to them. I've got naturally for harmonies. Willie Russell heard them and said, who's this woman? And he said, it's just, you know, some woman, Liverpool woman. And Willie thought it'd be nice if somebody who had that tone of voice and knew all the songs was in the show. I met the director. He was completely unimpressed because I looked like I was. I looked like a clerk. I spoke like a, you know. And I remember sort of having this disastrous interview with the director. I fell over a table on the way out. I couldn't wait to get out. And I stood up and turned around, and it was one of those rooms that was divided by a glass window. So he saw me go over the table. I was like, grabbed my eyes out all the way down the stairs. And on my birthday, about 2 weeks later, I got a phone call saying, this is the Liverpool Playhouse. We'd like you to join the chorus of Blood Brothers. So huge shock. Mum and dad, really supportive because I had my son who was 8 at the time. And they were like, yep, you've absolutely got to do this. The guy at the Venetian blind shop warned me against it.
Interesting.
He didn't.
There's always that, he isn't there?
He didn't think I should leave. And so again, went in. This is where I met the fabulous Drew Schofield, Davy Edge. Davy and I were playing and singing together the other week. Lifelong friends. Did Blood Brothers. We started in the January, I think it was 83. Went to London about 3 months later. And one night, 7:25, a call came up through the theatre. Tannoy, Miss Dixon will not be appearing. Miss Brown, can you please get into her clothes? Now, they didn't have an understudy costume, so they literally had to take the clothes off Barbara Dixon's body and put them on mine. Now, I don't know if anybody's actually seen Barbara Dixon in the flesh. She's 5'7". I'm 5'2". She takes a size 7 shoe. I take a 4. They had to stuff newspaper up her shoes and put them on my feet. They had to pin the dress clothes because, as I say, she was very skinny and God's been good. And then send me out in this massive coat, which covered my arms and hands. And the big remembering thing was I was at the side of the stage, the cast were all going, you'll be fine, you'll be fine. Yep. And I don't know whether it was a state of shock, to be honest, Michelle, because I was completely calm. I was like, yeah, okay. Yeah, all right. Yeah, all right. And at the side of the stage, I'm waiting to go on. And there's a big announcement, ladies and gentlemen, Miss Barbara Dixon will not be appearing. And there's a big, big groan. And I just thought, you've all paid £15 to see a Venetian blind saleswoman. That was the thought. So the next thing, there was a key, you know, the keyboard went off. And once I had a husband, you know, the sort of chap. And then I was on, you know, and we were away with it.
And it was just...
I was just so you know, I did 50 shows in the lead.
Incredible. What
an incredible well, 6 months before.
But there's so much.
Well, 6 months before I was selling Venetian blinds.
There's so much to unpick there because you tell it in such I just got on with it. But you don't mind me just going back a little bit. You've got your fabulous mum and dad, which again, we'll come on to your upbringing in a moment, who were just saying, you must do this. I wrote that down as you said it.
Yeah.
I mean, that brings tears to my eyes because what an endorsement for you. What a shove forward. And I know your mum was a singer and a publican and all that. And again, we'll come on to that. But What isn't it wonderful that they didn't go, oh my God, it's London, what are you doing? You know, they didn't put fear into you, they actually encouraged you. And that's huge.
No, they made me. Yeah, they said, you've got to do this, because also there was no guarantee that I would go from Liverpool to London, because at the time, equity, you had to work so many weeks in equity before you could transfer to London. But Barbara Dixon was, I want you as my understudy. We have a similar voice. I had my hair perm to look like hers. And her quote was, if you stood us back to back, we'd look like an Indian hatchet. The noses were very similar. And she felt comfortable with me. She didn't want a professional West End understudy. Because she was, it was a big journey for her as well. People forget that. So I've still got the card, the first night card she gave me. I've got such a lot of stuff. But mum and dad, Neil was nine by this time, I think, getting on for nine, eight, nine. And they were like, you must do this. And mum and dad shared the, you know, the looking after Neil while I was in London. Dad would live, you know, at my flat off Lock Lane with Neil during the week and then go home to, you know, he'd go home to mum during the day, take me to school. I actually think dad really liked it, because Lark Lane at that time, he was friends with the fishmonger. He was friends with the greengrocer. He walked my dogs in the park. He was having a great time. And then he'd go back to mum during the day, make sure everything was okay there. Because they were actually wardens of a sheltered housing scheme off Princess Avenue in Liverpool 12. Oddly enough, just over the road from Brookside. So, but this is obviously many years before. So they were like, no, you go and do this. And I came home every weekend with, you know, the Liverpool contingent. We came home every weekend and then went back on the, you know, Tuesday.
Phenomenal. And the other thing I want to, I mean, I don't know whether people have ever said to you, oh, you're so lucky that happened to you. But look, to me, it's about you seizing that opportunity. It was about making your own luck, isn't it? And actually so many people, and certainly more today more than ever, I think there's much more hesitation and comparison and self-judgment and criticism. Whereas, again, I'm sure you had your doubts, but you just went, I'm doing it.
It was extraordinary. I was 28. I had Neil at 17. I'd never really been away from Liverpool before for any length of time. So there was a lot of growing up done in that 6 months. I had to spend a lot of time on my own all of a sudden. You know, spoke to Neil every day. I remember crying my eyes out once. I phoned up to speak to Neil. And, you know, I missed him. He was my babby, you know. Yeah. And I said, hello, love, it's mommy. Very nice, your phone. Listen, Doctor Who's on, so I've got to go. Oh, I nearly drowned today. Bye. Put the phone down. What?
Yeah.
So at the age of nine, you know, it's all of that. It's being distanced from those you love. My best friend, who I was speaking to earlier, she's my best friend still, she was also really encouraging, really supportive. They tried to shush the fact that I'd gone on for Barbara, you know, tried to just like let that not sort of happen. She phoned the Echo and they sent someone round to photograph me down in London. And it was one of those, you know, Ethna Brown jumps for, they actually did want me to jump. And I went, no, I don't. You don't jump at 28, do you? You know, she jumps for joy. And I didn't sort of, you know, I'm not really that sort of person.
No.
Another funny thing was, after mum died, we found a scrapbook and she kept all sorts of stuff. We found those first things from Blood Brothers, things from Brookie, you know. It was quite a moving thing, but I couldn't have done it without them. They knew that and I knew that, you know, but it wasn't perfect. But, you know, let's be honest, nothing is. There were moments, if Neil wasn't well or I wasn't well, you've got to work with that. But behind it all was them going, they loved it. They came to London. Mum was part of it all. They loved being, you know, at the theatre. Mum sat next to one of the biggest things I gave her, I think, was that she was sitting next to an American in London at the time. Oh, gee, you know, who's this Barbara Dixon? I mean, if this is her understudy, she must be good. And mum was like, that's my daughter. You know, the Liverpool accent straight out the window. Suddenly my mother's from Eton, you know. That's my daughter. Yes. She was great at that. She could answer the phone in height better than anybody. Hello?
Hey, do you do that? I've noticed it on, I mean, my aunties and my mum were very, very, very similar. And that's, again, we'll come on to Chrissy in a minute because she was so relatable to my mum. I mean, my mum's not here anymore either, but it's brought back so many lovely memories just doing a little bit of research on you. And, you know, we do that, don't we? We're like chameleons because we know we're communicators. And whilst we're very proud of our accent, we definitely want to get our point across. So if we have to just slightly adapt it, then we will, you know.
I think that is such a good point for you to make. And when I'm working with younger students as well, there is something about your accent. Absolutely, absolutely. But the health chameleon thing, what is it you want to say? How do you want to be listened to? Know how to play the game. Know how to play the game. Doesn't mean you have to lose yourself. Doesn't mean you have to give up your accent, be unfaithful to your city or anything like that. Know how to play the game. I've got, I mean, you know, I think the voice on the Mersey Ferry is sort of the one that I use for that, is sort of slightly posh Liverpool Scouse sort of thing, because people from all over the world have to understand it.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I could go and go, so we're going past Birkenhead, you know, that mightn't do it. So be able to say, if you're leaving us here now at Birkenhead, it's still me.
Yes.
It's still me. And then on the phone to your mate, of course, you know, chat to your friends, you're from home.
Just completely yourself. I love that. And on the scrapbook thing, again, I am that mother. I mean, Hannah was in lots of the Bill Kenwright plays when she was young. She did Kenwright, but she did Joseph, Evita, Jekyll and Hyde, Whistle Down the Wind. I mean, she had a ball, but she also did Tuppence Across the Mersey. Again, totally different ball game, but what a confidence boost for her as a kid. You know, running around the back of the Empire Theatre. And, you know, again, and when she, but Tuppence was definitely one that we hold close to our heart because she was just, it was that Liverpool crowd, that Liverpool cast that we've kept in touch with a lot of them. And I did the whole scrapbook thing, you know, everything, the little cards and the story of Helen Forrester and the little Tuppence that Emma gave her and, you know, photographs and whatever. And it is lovely to look back on because she hasn't gone into performing and acting, but it's still part of her heart. But I know watching her that she's got this steely inner confidence that not a lot phases her. And I think I'm convinced that time in the theatre.
Yes, absolutely. That's why I work with a lot of younger students. I love to work with them from, you know, a young age upwards. The difference, I always use this as an example. Even if you don't become an actor, the fact that you are, because I do confidence classes for adults as well, and it's about stepping into somebody else if you need to. It's that thing of when you go for an interview, when you're in the world of adults and you have to go out there, you're going for a job or whatever, it's the difference between able to go, well, I've done this. I would like to ask you about having confidence in yourself, knowing how to get that across, even if inside you're absolutely shaking. Yes. The difference between a young person being able to do that, and they go, I don't know, whatever, yeah. Because they haven't got that inner self-esteem, self-confidence. To teach a young person that is to teach them a good step down the path to a better future. You know, being able to express themselves. There's a very simple technique that I've used, working with adults as well. And if you think about it, it's just like a pack of playing cards. We see ourselves quite often in society. You'll place yourself as a number, like a 3 or 4, you know, or an 8, 9, or 10. It's as simple as that. And you get them used to that idea of being able to click into a 7 or 8 to get them where they want to be at that time. It's a lovely thing. It works.
And I love how you're
I love seeing those people grow.
You're passing on that. You hear the term just a waitress or just a hairdresser or just a you're not a communicator. No. Those jobs are front facing.
You can't eat without you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know,
you're important. I won't have you are a. Absolutely do that. Absolutely love it. And it is that I was completely shy as a child, I never spoke, you know. And I when I was doing Brookside, I had, I think it was my godmother who'd gone to live in Canada. And she came back and we were taking her around doing the tour and stuff. She's like, oh my God, I can't believe this is little Ethna. You know, because I didn't, I suppose the mouth came 12, 13, along with the bosoms and the ability to make people laugh. Yeah. You know, that's the route I took, which hides a lot of insecurities, I suppose, looking back.
A lot of actors are quite shy, aren't they, naturally?
Yeah. A lot can be. A lot of actors can be. And that surprises people, but it's true. And that's why I love to work with young people and young children and make them see their own worth before anybody gets in there and starts cutting them down.
Yeah.
Most young people wanting to be actors, I just tell them, you've got to be able to hear the word no. If you can't take the word no, you can't be an actor, because you'll hear no more than yes. And you've got to be able to have other abilities so that you can work while you're waiting to be asked to be an actor or whatever, you know. And that's it, you know. Take the money, fund the dream.
Yeah, I love that. Take the money, fund the dream. And find another role to do. I always remember being quite proud of Hannah when we went for a couple of auditions and she used to say to me, Mum, why are they all crying? You know, at the end, because they didn't get it. She'd be like, can I have a man's ease now? You know, and good I was thinking, what? She'll be all right. You'll be all right, because she didn't get to her.
Yeah,
and that's what you want, isn't it? Like that whole inner confidence thing. But anyway, just coming back to the school and your shyness, and we were at the same school. I was like, okay, a fellow Broughton girl. I heard Sister Mary Agnes and Sister Columba, and I don't know whether I shook in my boots or it smiled inside. I was going, oh my God, this is bringing back all kinds of memories. Yeah. The nuns of Broughton Hall.
You're far too young. When I was there, we had Sister Mary Assumpter was the headmistress, and we had Sister Mary Columba for English at one time. Sister Mary Agnes taught geography.
For English. I had Sister Columba for English.
So, and it was extraordinary, because I left school without any levels at all, because it was O levels at that time, O levels and A levels. One of the oddest things was being asked back to Broughton Hall to speak to the girls.
Yeah.
So this was me who was not one of their bright and shining pupils at all. And that's another reason you can say you might not have this, but you can still go on to be. And Sister Mary Columba was just, oh, I'm so pleased, Jay. I was like, and it was so funny. I went in and going into that, you know, the reception area again, I had a bit of a shake on me. It was really odd. And I ended up saying, Sister, I think this is the first time I've stood outside the headmistress's office without 100 lines in my hands for about 40 years. I was impish. I think that's it. When I was at school, I was not the best pupil. I wasn't like, you know, disruptive or rude or anything like that, but I did.
You just hadn't found your voice yet, had you? And you know, you left Broughton Hall and went straight into a job. I've heard it involved talking and putting on accents and you know, all that. And that's when you obviously coming back to that, oh, you're so lucky. You were preparing yourself for this future career without a doubt, in those roles.
Yeah. It was so funny as well, coming back to that, one of the very sort of first proper job I had, I worked at a place, and the warehouse has just been demolished in the past year, so I was actually quite sad. It was behind TJ Hughes for years and years and years, and it was called D. Huglin London Limited, 207-3532. I can't remember what happened last Tuesday, but hello, D. Huglin London Limited, can I help you? There we are. But also, I was very numerical. The alphabet was good, so I actually got all the filing into order, and they gave me a weekly raise about 6 months or 3 months after I was there. And I learned a lot. I learned a lot how to work within a team. The women were brilliant. And also old Mr. Huglin, it was at a time when you went to the bank with your money on a Friday in a suitcase. You know, it was a very vibrant district. They call it the Fabric District now. Yeah. You'd be walking around there and somebody would be taking a rail of clothing from one building to another. It was a great place to work. I absolutely loved being around there. And I love the job. And one of the oddest things was Victor Huglin, who was Mr. Huglin's son, took over the business. And he was sort of growing up. While I was growing up, he was a couple of years older than me. Not much. And it was when he took clients of his to see Blood Brothers in London, and he went, "That's my telephonist."
Oh. Love it.
You tell those people to say Barbara Dixon in London, and there was the woman who used to answer his phones on the, you know, he sent me a big bouquet of flowers and going, "Oh my God, well done." But that must have been so weird for him to be sitting in the Lyric Theatre in London, and then Ethna, "Hello, D. Hedlund London Limited," you know, comes on and plays the leading role. There's lots of funny things like that happened. So that was the start of it. Back then, you literally could just go from job to job. I needed to change jobs because of where Neil was at school or when we were moving house or whatever, I was always in work. And they had, I have to be honest and say, they had nurseries then that were reasonably priced, set up so that women post-war would be able to work. That's what they were set up for. There were, like, the Corpy nurseries were everywhere and they were good. And so I was able to be a working mum. And you know, and still have a reasonable life, yeah.
And did you still spend time? I know you grew up. Your mum was a publican. Your dad was just the seaman. And again, another beautiful story around your upbringing. You're one of seven, weren't you? And was your mum still? Did she still have the pub? And was she still singing? And
no, she was a complete performer. Loved it. No, it was my grandmother's pub. My grandma and granddad owned the pub, and it's still there. It's the Castle on Vauxhall Road. So it was still there. Granddad met, he was a seaman, and he met my dad. Dad left Ireland when he was 15, 16, ran away to sea, but worked really hard, worked his way up through the Merchant Navy and became a captain, master mariner, sailed the world. And then as the family grew bigger, he sort of worked for more local firms like Coastlines, P&O, the ones that would do the Liverpool, Dublin, Belfast route, you know, so he'd be home more often. But Mum was a fantastic singer. She really was. She'd sing in the pub at weekends. There was always music around us. Nanny had a dance set on the bar, and she would have all of these 78s brought back from America or wherever the sailors had been. You know, a lot of music came into Liverpool because of it being a port. So, you know, we were listening to these amazing stories and amazing music. Sort of, there wasn't really the telly vibe that was going on then. You know, I don't know how old we were when I first got television, but we were always around music. Mum, self-taught accordionist, piano player, and so you would hear her singing every night. She was in choirs. She sang at people's weddings, things like that. She's an amazing, amazing singer. Yeah. Gorgeous. And so she loved the Blood Brothers thing. You know, she was meeting all of these people and sort of through me. But also, if there was an opportunity at a party or whatever to get my mum on a mic, I'd love it. Yes. Go on, Mum, you sing. You sing. Because she had more confidence than I ever had. She was a complete natural show person. And to bring it back to Tumps Across the Mersey, that very first outing at the Empire Theatre, Helen Forrester was still alive, so we got to meet her. And there was one night, it was a special evening for the Roy Castle Foundation, and Roy Castle couldn't make it, he wasn't well enough. But it didn't matter, because there was Kitty Brown at the top of the stairs as people were sweeping into the bar to join the celebrations post-show. "Oh, hello, yes, welcome," you know. Kitty's there in a best Harrods accent, but the fake fur coat and welcoming people, chatting to everybody. "Yes, that was my daughter. And I just absolutely loved it." So she was, I think I lived her dream, if I'm honest.
Yes.
She would have.
I was actually just going to ask you that.
Yeah. I think so.
What she'd have felt when she saw you. I mean, again, I keep coming back to Hannah because I can't, but it skipped me. But I mean, I've loved the theatre, and Blood Brothers was the very first show I went to see in Liverpool. I was like, jaw on the floor in the 80s. In fact, I saw it when it came around the schools. There was four people playing.
Yeah.
And that was my first, like, oh, and then my auntie and uncle took me to see it in the 80s. I was 11, 12 or whatever it was. And
so I was in the chorus.
Every single word. I did the classic hit, in the bedroom, the tape on, repeat, rewind, with the, you know, I was Bob, I was Mrs. Johnson. In fact, I was all of them. Yeah. Mickey, the lot.
It's like that.
Yeah, so, your mum must be beside herself, because I remember my mum when Hannah was on the stage. Yeah. She was like a tiny little dot, but everyone around where my mum was sitting knew it was her granddaughter. And we don't have to tell everybody in the empire.
Oh my God, she was so proud, you know.
And it's like, so, and your mum being a performer herself, she must have just basically, I mean, what a gift you've given her in terms of.
Yeah, I always thought that, if nothing else, you know, if nothing else, you sort of got that. And Neil, I remember at the time, because Neil has Asperger's, my son. He's 50 now, and he was 9 at the time, but it was like his view on things and how he saw the world. And he sort of said to Barbara, I thought you did very well. You were more interesting than E.T.
That's honest.
She was saying, oh my God, what a compliment. I'm more interesting than E.T. And she was gorgeous. For him, that was a wonderful time as well, because everybody just, and some of the other people had children as well, but they just took Neil into their, you know, into their arms as well. So it was an exciting time for Neil. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, and again, wonderful memories for him. So obviously we keep going and banging on about Blood Brothers because it's such a phenomenal musical. One of the most successful musicals of the last 25 years. But you obviously went on to do many other things. Shirley Valentine, Rita, really strong women. You play strong women and Chrissy, obviously, in Brookside.
Yeah.
You know, do you have a favourite character that you've played, or is there one that you would do again in a heartbeat? Or
well, just one that people won't know about, but in Liverpool, even though it was called Maggie May, and it's quite a recent one, and it wasn't about Maggie May, it was the Rod Stewart song, and it was a woman who had got a diagnosis of early dementia. And while it sounds like, oh, it would be depressing, it wasn't. It was so hopeful. It was developed over a couple of years. And you know what? Honestly, Michelle, it was one of those weird, out of the blue things. I was sitting in a cafe with my mates on a Wednesday, got a call saying, hello, darling, I don't suppose you're available this Friday, are you? Can you get to Leeds? And I was. And it was so funny because I got to sort of stay over. And it was a play reading. They were developing this new play. And I walked in and there was an ex-boyfriend playing my husband. Oh, hello. Thank you very much.
Oh. Extra lippy on.
Yeah, I'm fine. Oh, yeah, I'm fine. Thank you. So, that was the first play reading. That was the first shot. But the first play reading and the Maggie May connection was her husband kept bringing her back to now and herself with the songs that they sang.
Okay.
And they first met and he asked her, you know, Maggie May, are you dancing sort of thing? This play could play anywhere. And I actually got nominated for a National Theatre Award for it last year. So it was a biggie for me. That's never happened to me before. Lead character, never off the stage. And it was very dramatic in parts. And also it was very funny and moving. And it was completely hopeful. It was full of, this is how you live with this, as opposed to this is you're going to die with it. This is how you live with this. I worked with a fantastic writer, director, female again, very important that their work is recognised. Shirley Valentine, I followed great mates doing that. Kate Fitzgerald in particular, I saw first doing it. I know Pauline Daniels has done it. A lot more younger women coming up to do it since. My mate Keddie Sutton did it. It's a lonely show to do because there's nobody but you. But it's down to brilliant writing. Yeah. Willie writes well for women. Educating Rita, I did on tour. And that was a bit naughty because one of the lines was, I'm 28 and I haven't had a baby yet. 26, I haven't had a baby yet. And I was 42 at the time. And I'm sort of thinking, and the rest, love.
That's a good one.
Well, you know, I was far away, could get away with it. So I've been asked to play some wonderful women. Wonderful, wonderful. Yes. Sorry.
And even Anne Twackey was a wonderful woman in her own way.
Dennis Doe. I loved him. I loved it.
Yes.
So,
well, Britpop, they say, Dave Coyle calls, apparently, just in on that. You know, Dave, I have interviewed on the podcast and very kindly was my first guest. I'm glad we could talk for Britain.
And his story... You do surprise me. Yeah. What a fantastic story.
It just, again, so cleverly done. Yeah. And, yeah. you know, a real, he brought theatre to the masses of Liverpool in terms of theatre has historically been seen potentially as for others. And he brought it to the real world, you know, what was yeah. he and Nicky and you as a cast. And, you know, it made the Royal Court what it was, and it changed theatre for probably for many theatres and for years to come.
It did in Liverpool. So many people afterwards. We were having the time of our lives. Funny enough, just on Saturday, Jonathan Harvey was in our dressing room as we were getting ready to do the show at the court on Saturday afternoon. And he said, oh, about Brickop, you know, you were in that, weren't you? Because it's 15, 16 years ago. Mm. And we were having the time of our lives. It was like summer camp. We never wanted it to end. I remember that first year when it first kicked off, Suzanne, and I, and this is when the Royal Court Theatre was still, we all take it for granted, it's beautiful and it's comfortable. It was shoddy at the time, shabby, put it that way. Yeah. She was a shabby queen. And it really showed signs of it as well. It's always beautiful, always beautiful, but definitely signs of wear and tear. I remember we looked out of our little dressing room window and they were queuing right round it, gone beyond, you know, the pub next door, the penny farthing. People queuing to come in, big queues. And it was amazing for us as performers, A, because we were having a great time. The music was brilliant. The writing was incredible. Again, you were working with people who became your friends if you hadn't known them before. And that roar that went up at the end, you never wanted to leave the stage. It's a contract between the audience and the cast, and we fulfilled that contract every night. So many people would come to me going, I never thought the theatre was for me. They were scared to cross, and you know the doorway. And I'm saying, please, I said it again to people on Saturday. This theatre's yours. You've bought it. You've made it.
Added a pound to every ticket. It was so clever, wasn't it? Yeah. I don't know whether they still do that. You just pay now, but they should keep that up if they're not. But what a phenomenal idea! And such a simple thing.
At the moment, a pound for every ticket is going to Ukraine. A pound for every ticket was going to be free for this.
Yeah.
So that was it. So it opened the theatre for so many people. I was at a meeting years before.
It was over 200,000 from what I remember Dave saying. It did a few runs, didn't it? Because I know Patrick's seen it. It was his rite of passage when we got together. Yeah. It's like, if you don't laugh, you're binned.
If you don't laugh, we're going to the doctors. There's something wrong. But it was wonderful because it was. I remember one night. I was in the interval. I was dressed in my Aunt Twacky, me long night in my robe, and I'm taking cups of coffee upstairs to Drew and people, and I tripped on the stairs, and I just cut through my hand with the edge of a cup, and I was like, no, I'm okay. Just put plaster on. When they looked at it, it obviously needed attention. And I was taken to the hospital once we'd finished. And they were like, we'll have to keep you in overnight. You've got to have an operation. And I lied to get out of the hospital because I knew the next night we had something. I think it was 1, 2, 3, 4. That were the audience figures for the Tuesday. It was the last week. And I thought, it can't go anywhere else. You can't put the people in next week because it's closed. You know, it's finishing. So I was first up in the theatre. Got this operation on my hand, got a splint put on and everything, and I had. So Aunt Twacky was there that night on stage. Don't make me use this splint, Dennis. It was just, and everybody accepted it, you know. But it was, it was incredible. The theatre was full. There were no spare seats, and I just thought, I can't not be there. It was all last week, you know. And when it comes down to it, that does sound very dramatic, but it was just I'd cut the tendon on my finger or something that, you know, so.
That's pretty dramatic, Anthony. And that is a classic, the show must go on story, isn't it? You know, fantastic. I love how you're talking about the people you surround yourself with, because again, that's a massive message, isn't it? You are the sum of those people who you work with. And I'm sure there's a lot of egos in your world, but if you can nail those those people who are doing it for the love of it and yeah. you know, for the joy and that connection with the audience and what they're giving to the audience. Mm. It must be the best job in the world.
It is. It absolutely, when you've got that, it's like at the moment, I'm working with people who I really care about. Yeah. Not, you know, Lindsay Germain, Keddy Sutton, yeah. we go back. We yeah. support each other on stage. I dropped a line, Lindsay picked it up. I was like, oh my God, thank yeah. you. You know, that sort of thing. I've worked with people who, when you talk about egos, I tend not to get them on stage here. I've had them. I know exactly what you're talking about. But here, because it's home and it's family, yeah. we tend to be a bit more, you know, supportive. So that's a wonderful thing. You walk in feeling safe, but we can deliver the goods. And I think that's really important. That to me, if I come off stage and I don't feel I've given my best, I'm not, you know, I'm not happy at all. So, but you're working with friends who are going, yeah, that's fine. You're good, you know. But going back to that point of people who are saying, theatre wasn't for me. I didn't think theatre was for me. So many more people that you would be able to say, go to the Everyman, or now you can go to the Playhouse, or go to the Empire. Theatre is so important in so many people's lives. It takes them out of themselves. This building's got history, and it's our history. Yeah. And I'm not one of those, Arnold Scouser's brilliant. I don't do that. I love Liverpool. I love England. I love Europe. You know, I love the world. It's that. But please, please, celebrate your heritage. Celebrate what was left for you to live in. I love that. Mm. Love that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And Liverpool is like a culture heritage galore, isn't it? Oh, you know. And what's so brilliant, coming back to the Eurovision, you know, what we're hoping that the ultimate outcome of that, we had that phenomenal week, but what we want is that, and Claire would say that legacy of our kids want to stay. They want their mates to come, the kids come to uni, they want to stay. You know, and get that economy going, and you know, not just relying on tourism, but you know, the rest and culture. But I mean, that is ultimately the backbone of this city, without a doubt. Yeah. But we want people to come here and see what else there is to offer, and that you can have a wonderful life living here. And that's what's and the Royal Court and all your contributions is massive towards making that happen. You know, you do have that immediate uplifting impact, but it's a longevity factor. It's people want to come back. On that note, I've brought in Patrick. I did let you know earlier on that we were going to bring in Patrick. I'm sorry. I saw you waving. I knew that was going to happen. He's like, hello, I'm here. Going to let me.
I've been very patient listening to you, but it's been wonderful listening. And I've been sitting here for most of the time with a broad grin on my face, because I've just been loving listening to Ethna's stories and so on. And, you know, picking up on the last bit, Ethna, about, you know, I've been in Liverpool for nearly 10 years now, and I found it an amazingly welcoming city, you know, in terms of the city's ability to welcome and bring in, whether you're outsiders, visitors and so on. And I'm just, yeah, I've lived in quite a few big cities around the world in my life. And This place is boss. I can say that. This place is absolutely boss.
Yeah, I want better for Liverpool. I want more for Liverpool. I'm not one of those people who go, oh yeah, we're the best in the world. But no, we're not. There's always room for improvement.
Yeah, the ingredients are there, and most of all, it's the vibe and the people. Yeah, when I came to Liverpool, the energy and the passion, and it's still there. Whether it's 10 years ago or today, the energy and the passion. Of everybody who lives here is unparalleled. I haven't come across it anywhere else. And I suspect that a lot of people who've moved into Liverpool from let's say outside, moved up from London or from overseas, feel the same way. I mean, you can't help but fall in love with the city and what it's about. And so the can-do attitude, I sort of picked up and... In fact, before I came to Liverpool, I always thought of can-do attitude as a real Americanism. But it really, really sums up what, you know, the general, you know, what people are about here. It's, yes, we can do this. And, yeah, it's such a positive outlook. And, as I say, ingredients are all there for an amazing city.
That's really, really good to hear. I completely agree. And when you're meeting people who have come to work here, want to stay, the universities, of course, are bringing a lot of people in. And they go, why would you live anywhere else? As long as we have the work for them to stay here, for them to build, you know, as long as the employment is there, because we know how much it's suffered. But I'm glad you felt so welcomed. And, you know, you felt
I did. You know, the other, I mean, listening to you so far, you know, a couple of other little sort of connections. My dad was in the Merchant Navy as well. He didn't go to sea like yours, but he came up to Liverpool regularly. Yeah. And it was because of that that I ended up, I was actually born in Kenya. And he was, my dad was sent out to Kenya in the early 1960s with the, he worked for Element City Liners, who had a big office in Liverpool as well.
Yeah, I know.
And so I was born and brought up in Kenya. And your whole, when you were talking about accents, I absolutely get it. You know, when I was sent to boarding school from Kenya, and I was sent to boarding school in England at the age of 13, I always had, everybody said, why do you sound odd? You know, where does that accent come from? And of course, to me, it was just, that's just how I spoke. What people said. Was a sort of a soft South African accent. It was what we call a Kenyan accent, but I had a very strong accent at that age, and then over the years it slowly sort of faded out, and then when I moved up to Liverpool, of course, nearly 10 years ago, you would thought, well, we live in the same country, but you know, you're obviously not from here, and you got a posh Southern accent, and it was almost like Groundhog Day was starting over again. But have you ever had to? And do you find it to learn an accent? Have you had to learn various accents for certain roles?
There are certain roles I won't do because I know I can't do them well. And I just think employ a woman who speaks like that. I can get away with a few. Like Maggie May, she was like, I sort of call it General Northern. You know, I hang around the Pennines and hope somebody will employ me. So, you know, that sort of thing. She was like, morning. That's, you know, so I could do that. Scottish accents, no. Newcastle, I don't go anywhere near them. I once went for an audition, it was Siding with Rosie, and I started off like that, and I was giving it loads of that, and it was all going very, very well, and I thought I was doing ever so well with it, and then she said, oh, can you turn over? There's more on the next page. So as I turned over the page, I left Devon. We passed up through Wales at some point, concentration. I just said to him, I said it when I finished it. I said, that was like a bus trip around Britain, wasn't it, by the end of it? So, and I've got, I sort of get a bit of an Irish accent going. I'm not sure if it's still there, but there was a video of me taken years and years ago down to the Maritime Museum, and it was about the famine, the Irish famine, and how people came through Liverpool and went all over the world. And so I went down to have this recorded, and I'd done my hair like I thought it was, you know, it would be at the end of the 19th century, whatever. And they gave me this hat to wear, which I had to tie around my head. And it had the effect of making me look like a hamster. It's just like, look. And it looked like I'd caused the famine single-handedly, like eating every spud in this fat woman going, oh, it was, what was it? I had to leave Ireland, and it was the potatoes. And I think it was the way I said potatoes. Potatoes. And my dad used to bring people down to laugh at me.
Wow.
It was so bad. It was so bad. There are certain accents I can do.
The Irish, because you've got the Irish back roots.
I might have the Irish in me, but it doesn't always come out verbally, dear. It's, you know, you don't always have that choice.
Your dad, where to us, I mean, we obviously have got Irish roots as well, but it sounds brilliant to me. I'm sure it's fine. I think you gave me a bit self-critical there, Mrs.
No, I did a play reading in Manchester, oddly enough, earlier this year, and there was an Irish accent to be used, and she said it was very good. The director quite liked it, so that was okay. But I prefer not to, you know, if I think I can do it and do it well, then yes, but if not, because it's that thing, you know yourself, if people hear a bad Scouse accent, it's awful. So I don't want to be the person. That was the Maggie May job, the one I got the theatre nomination award thing. That was my sort of Pennines type accent. And I was extremely worried that when the reviews came out, it would be why didn't you use somebody from Yorkshire? Or, okay. You know, so I got away with it.
Oh, that was great.
Well, yeah. Living with a Scouser and married to a Scouser, I still haven't managed to pick
up some prayers, babe.
The vocabulary, but no accent.
Dave keeps going, has Pat mastered the Scouse accent yet? Every time he I go, no.
It'll come because all the accents I've learned over my life have all been via osmosis over a period of time. Yeah. I've never been able to just learn an accent sort of by listening to recordings.
You say made up now, though. You said I remember when we were early days and you said you came home from a very important meeting and said, can you believe I caught myself saying I'm made up in the... And again, that's a term that we just assume everybody says.
Yeah. I can imagine if you went back to Kenya, you know, then that would still be in you there, and then you would develop, and you know, I think you have to try harder, Patrick. I really
do. I'll try harder. But the other thing is sort of connected with it when you were talking about actors having to get used to the word no, and you being told that maybe one of your accents you'd adopted was a bit dodgy. It goes back to this thing about being resilient, doesn't it? You have to have built, coping mechanisms and quite a thick skin to be able to take criticism, whether it's constructive criticism or actually just criticism. And where does that come from? And, you know, you talked about being a shy child. Did that strength and inner strength and the energy that goes with it, because it's not as if over the decades you've been sort of beaten down. You've got probably, I have known you for decades, but you still seem to have a huge amount of energy. But where does that strength and resilience and perseverance come from?
I think it's experience in the end, isn't it? Because I've been given lots of different opportunities. There have been terrible disappointments. And also I found it, the confidence wasn't really there. I was 28 when I was asked to do Blood Brothers. I was about 30, just a year or so, 2 years later, I was asked to go for a singing audition. And I just walked out halfway through and said, I'm awfully sorry. I can't bear to listen to this, even if you can. When I'm working with students, your voice starts there. You've told yourself you can't sing this. Mm-hmm. This is going to be, that happens. Your voice closes over. Now I sort of, it sounds irreverent to say, I don't care, but it doesn't matter as much. I still want the job. I still want to do it well. Still want to be able to sing well and do that. But I've got more confidence now in how it comes out. And that's something that only experience, I think, and age can give you. For somebody like me, some people, I didn't have the training. I wasn't used to standing in front of people singing various songs and what have you. I absolutely adore it now. I'll sing anywhere. That's got me thrown out of places. but I don't have that nervousness now that I have confidence in what I know I can do. I still say no to things I don't think I can do well.
Detaching yourself from the outcome. Don't attach yourself and attach your value and your self-worth to somebody else's decision.
Yeah. It's really hard because you go for an audition and you might have to wait for two, especially younger people now. There's so many more younger people wanting to be actors and the opportunities are there, but you might have to wait 2-3 weeks. And you think that person's already made up their mind about me, probably. That person could have already said that, and you don't know yet. So you're in this limbo while you're waiting for somebody to say yes or no to you. And it's a hard place for a younger person to be, or an older person, or somebody whose job, that job might make a whole difference to their life in terms of finances.
Yeah.
It's such a tricky thing. There have been times where a yes would have made a heck of a difference to my life at that time. And it was a no, and you had to just suck that up and get on with it. You can't be an actor and not deal with no. And that's something I try and get across to young people.
Patrick and I, our latest sort of hot topic is midlife, as we are both sort of well planted within it now, in denial for a while, but, you know, state of acceptance. That midlife mindset, or midlife muddle, as I like to call it, you know, your energy, Ethna, and your passion for life and your go-getting ways and acceptance of outcomes and what top... Did that change as you got older? Like, I think you've just almost answered that question saying you've got older and you've become more resilient. But in terms of that midlife, did you ever have that wobble? No. There's so many people though that sort of hit a certain age and they'll, you know, think, oh, I'm X age now, can't do that.
No.
Great. You know, and literally just almost life stops for them in a way, or their dreams stop.
Surround yourself with and talk to people and just go, no, this is it. I'm breathing. You're breathing. You wake up, you go and do it. I don't tend to have that sort of mindset. I am older. Things hurt. I can still high kick, but only with the right leg. And, you know, I'm used to sort of exposing myself for criticism. You know, you're up there on a stage or in a daily way, but I count myself so lucky. I've been asked to do so many different things. It's not just being on stage at the Royal Court. Keep yourself open for all sorts. It doesn't have to be, I'm on the West End stage and earning £1,000 a month. Yeah, so I never take it for granted. So we do these sort of cabaret type afternoons, evenings. The Palm House, there'll be one at the Palm House coming up later in the year. Yeah. So I do those a lot, and it's bringing your friends around you and giving them work. Yeah. You get to sing together, people enjoy it. There'll be poetry readings from maybe Shirley Valentine, something else. Yeah. And lots of music. So they're great to do. Thank you. I'd forgotten about that.
Such a gorgeous conversation. We could obviously just keep talking. We didn't even get onto your beautiful upbringing, Heighton, and walking past the cows, and you know, your endless weekend trips to Ireland. And I was like, cows in Heighton? What?
Yeah.
Chrissy, yeah. I have to give her a little nod because it brought back memories of watching Brookie with my mum. What a beautiful character she was. And I'm just going to show you this because this is on my shelf, but I just grabbed it. And I thought, God, this is my picture next to my podcast. And I thought, hang on, where are we now? Does that not look like Chrissy? That's my mum.
Oh, my gosh, that's brilliant.
Isn't it?
Your mum. I was saying, that looks like my jacket. That looks like something I've worn. Oh, my God. Oh, that's absolutely brilliant. I was like,
Chrissy Rogers, let me just have a little look here.
Fantastic.
But I was like,
I would have sworn that was me. So, what's your dad's name?
I won't even go there, but that's a whole other
podcast. No, you mustn't. Let's be reverential to your mother. I think that's brilliant.
Isn't it? So thank you for the memory of Chrissy. We didn't get into Brookside and all that, but you know what? I know theatre's your first love. Anyway, I mean, I'm not knocking obviously all that, but I know theatre's your first love, and that's what lights you up. And that's absolutely shone through today. You're just this breath of air, breath of fresh air, and positive energy, passion, funny, humorous.
I'm on very heavy medication.
Honest. Well, I'll tell you what, tell me what it is because I want some.
Oh my God, sugar in there.
Your energy does light people up, Hefner. And, you know, Dave did tell me that. I mean, we have met briefly before on occasion, but it's always been a million people in a room or after shows and things like that. So it's been a complete honour and a privilege to have this one-to-one time with you, honestly. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been wonderful to be asked,
Thank you. Patrick, did you want to add anything before we close?
Just to say, wonderful listening. And Ethan, I'll have to call you the next time we meet to ask all the questions that I wanted to ask you and discuss all the things.
Yeah. I can come back.
I've got lists. So.
We can do the podcast, Ethna Brown, the early years.
Part two and part three.
And part four and five.
No.
Season.
Thank you so much. It's been lovely.
Thank you. Honoured to be asked.
You've been listening to the Talk On To Walk On podcast, which is just one part of our wider offer. Our mission is to remind the world that conversation should never be underestimated. But we also know that many conversations need a lot of courage and confidence. That's why Patrick and I have created Elevate Your Mindset under the Talk On To Walk On brand. If you think you, your team or your students would enjoy working with us to walk on in life with confidence, then go to our website, talkontowalkon.com. You'll learn more about us, our coaching, mentoring and talks offer. You can also follow Talk On To Walk On Instagram, Facebook and YouTube. Finally, taking a moment to rate, review and subscribe or even sponsor our podcast will really help us spread our Power of Conversation message. Remember, the simplest act can have the largest impact. So let's connect, have a conversation, and you never know where it will lead.